to think about a man when we say something like holistic womb, but I do treat men as well. And the thing about the holistic womb is it's not just a physical organ, but it also holds a lot of creativity and the ability to hold life. And so treating the womb holistically is going to involve lots of different facets of health, the mental, emotional, as well as the physical.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting when you say that you specialize in pelvic floor, mm-hmm. in craniosacral.
Yes.
And it's interesting the tie. Well, how do those...
And the jaw.
And the jaw, yeah.
So, yes.
How do all those things tie together? Because right. I know you have a great explanation for this.
Well, I was just talking about this with my husband as I'm starting my new practice, is when I go to the dentist and orthodontist, how is it going to be when I say, yeah, you can reach me at holisticwomb.com? So, you know, there's some business development there I'm going to work on. But the jaw and the pelvis are related. They are on the top and the bottom of the kinematic chain of the spine. So they mimic each other mechanically. You can also see the relation in the in orifices and the out orifices, the beginning of the digestive tract and the end of the digestive tract, and then also the autonomic nervous system. And that's where craniosacral comes in. So craniosacral is a manual therapy that treats the cranium and the sacrum and everything in between, because the cerebral spinal fluid bathes all that central nervous system. So when you are treating the jaw and you make an adjustment there, that affects the cranial sacral system. And if you are treating the pelvis or the sacrum or the pelvic floor, there's also going to be a shift because of the autonomic nervous system. Does that help?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're treating the jaw, are you like physically just massaging the jaw and the inside of the mouth and helping readjust those things for the cranial and everything?
Yes, and more. So the jaw joint is super small, but it still needs to have good surface gliding and orthopedic integrity. So there's not much space. So it's millimeters, right? So millimeters of change in your hip is not a big deal, but in your jaw it is. So that's why we start talking about the cranium as well. So the suture joints and the jaw are related. So I don't just treat the jaw, but I treat all the joints that are next to the jaw to make sure the jaw's in a good place. So yes, it does involve internal releasing. So it involves the cranial adjustments and then also re-education of the muscles. So just like any injury in the body, if there's an injury, you want to clear up the congestion and make sure the orthokinematics are awesome, and then train the muscles to hold that position.
So when you treat men, are you doing the same exact practice for each individual, or is it different for a male and female?
It is going to be different for male and female, and it's going to be different from woman to woman. So it's not a cookbook kind of approach. So often what happens is someone will come to me for one issue, and then through history taking, it's like, oh, I also have clicking in my jaw. Or, oh, yeah, I also, you know, leak when I cough. So that happens a lot, but sometimes there's not a connection. So then I wouldn't do those kind of protocols between the jaw and the pelvic floor or the pelvis. I was trained early on by some of the pioneers, and they developed both of these specialties at the same time. And it became very clear that if you cannot get the pelvic floor to release, then if you do a jaw release, it's more successful in getting the release in the pelvic floor. So I've seen that anecdotally a lot.
Wow. That's crazy. So if someone's listening to this conversation and saying, wow, I have TMJ, my jaw is locked up.
Yeah.
Does it can explain, or you can start to think about your pelvic floor. And even if you are a man, think about your prostate and maybe misfirings there? I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. I like that you used the term misfiring, because that's exactly what happens when you are in a tensed, kind of guarded state, that you don't have the reflexive nature of those muscles to turn on and off to give you the stability and the function. So the anatomy of a female is more vulnerable than a man in the pelvic floor region. So there's just a lot more predispositions for women. And then you talk about menstruation and pregnancy and delivery, and then that's another predisposition for injuries. So there's a lot, I see men a lot less, they have less issues. For men, prostate, yes, sometimes the inflammation is something that can be cleared up through pelvic floor PT, hernias, and then also post-op surgery. So anytime there's a surgery in that area, the pelvic floor needs to be kind of reset so it can fire appropriately. So does that answer your question?
Yes, it's really interesting and making me think of other things. And by the way, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Heather Jean DeFord of Holistic Womb. She's a physical therapist, longtime physical therapist here in the Park City area. And now you're practicing out of Camas, is that right?
I'm renting space. So I have my own practice. I'm renting space in Camas and in Park City. So,
Okay. And just what it made me think about is that men, there's some statistic about once you are 70, if you are a man, there's a pretty good chance of having prostate cancer. And I'm wondering if things like that can be staved off, or even prostate dysfunction, if it can be staved off by physical therapy, you know, just seeing what's ahead.
There's no research out there for that right now, but when I think about the systems involved, and any time that you tune up an area, that you decrease congestion, you have all the systems of flow optimal, so that the immune system in that area is great, and the nerves and blood flow, I think that that area is, you know, less predisposed to something like cancer. So it's kind of in the same conversation of like eat healthy, exercise, drink lots of water, you know, make sure that your organs are healthy. The pelvic abdominal cavity is rich in a lot of function. And if that has congestion and tension, then anything in that pelvic abdominal cavity can be compromised. So tension, you know, we hold it a lot in our gut. And so this is all part of pelvic, you know, floor, pelvic abdominal PT that is out there. That's what I offer.
What about these workshops? I mean, are you getting a bunch of people with the same type of issue that are coming to these things? Or so is each individual workshop catered to different types of symptoms? Or is it a whole approach that allows each individual to cater to whatever they're going through at that time?
Yeah, great questions. So when people have issues, symptoms, pain, lack of performance, that would be more of an individual one-on-one. So when people come into the pelvic floor workshops, I'd like to have some, you know, intake with them and see where they're at. Because if they're coming in with some misfiring, then I think it's going to be important to clear that up before it's in a class setting. So the classes that I'm offering in the workshops, they're more centered around prevention. So been doing this for a really long time, and women from ages 17 to 77 will always say, like, why didn't I hear about this sooner? And so, you know, I want everyone to be able to access my care, and if they can't, then that's where the education can be a starting point. So if it's you can't come into a one-on-one session, then that's a great place to start, because I'm going to be offering a lot of free classes as well. The rite of passage yoga workshop is going to be all, you know, catered to 5th and 6th graders. The perinatal yoga class that I'm putting on has that their audience. So I think more so the classes will draw in people that are looking for answers in that area.
Got it. As always, I got to ask selfish questions.
Sure.
Because I've had back pain from ski injuries, and I've had sinus issues, which have created headaches. And so reading some of your website, you know, you talked about treating headaches. And so those types of two issues with some of my symptoms, what would happen for me?
Well, what happens in the lower spine can definitely have effects up throughout the upper spine. And so treating the spine holistically is always a good idea. And that's where craniosacral, that specific manual therapy modality, can be really helpful for someone in your situation. The cranium is a super fun place to work when you can get that releases. And clearing of sinuses is often what the benefits are that people report. Yeah.
I'm in.
You're in. Yeah. And so, what's, you know, and everyone who's listening can even kind of consider this as like a way, and you kind of understand how these two parts of the body is connected. So if you engage your core, right, and just, you know, give yourself a core engage, and if you can and tune into your jaw, what's happening at your jaw? So that mindfulness, and this is what kind of you'll learn at these workshops and when one-on-one session, is that body awareness, that just because one area of your body doesn't tense up, doesn't mean they all do. And so learning that firing system is the beginning of what you are looking into, of what you're trying to accomplish.
One of your other missions, Heather, is to help young women especially sort of usher in these transitions in life. And I have heard you talk before about this transition that young girls go through, and unfortunately they're going through at a younger and younger and younger age, and that is starting their menstruation. And I remember as a young girl, I was so freaked out and ashamed, I didn't even tell my mother. And so I don't even know how I sort of, I must have asked girlfriends how to go through this thing. Thankfully, now we have things like lots of free feminine care products in public bathrooms. And and we're tuned in to it. Half of our population experiences this every month.
Right.
So why is there shame around it?
Right, that makes me really sad. And you know, we are super fortunate in this culture, because there are many cultures where girls are hiding it. Girls aren't going to school because they are hiding it and they don't have products. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to look at it in that perspective, because I feel like we have a lot of areas to grow. And I do think that it's changing. I think that young men are becoming more sensitive, and it's not as a taboo subject. It's not as mystifying. You know, they're learning about the menstrual cycle as it relates to procreation and how it's, you know, affecting your sisters, your mom, your girlfriend, your, you know, daughter. And so it is changing. and I you ask why isn't it just a kind of an obvious no-brainer that it's more a part of our culture? And you know, I don't know. I don't know. It is it's not that glamorous to talk about. It's not that comfortable to talk about either. So I think that's the nuts of it, and why, like, it's why it's really hard.
And then, you know, somewhere in the years following the beginning, the onset of menstruation, you know, hopefully quite a bit later, we start talking about our own sexuality. And you really want women to experience their own sexuality in a very positive way. Again, lots of strange, I don't know, shame and secrets and dysfunction regarding sexuality. How do you help usher women into that stage where you know you're going to be your best self, you're going to enjoy it, you're going to have it work for you as well as it works for men?
Well, that is, you know, I always want to promote that it's a very personal process. And I think there's a lot of ideas of what it should be looking like. So I think that's one of the first things, just to like let go of and really embrace your own personal journey in your sexual life. There's some other really great movements in education and how women can have more of a voice and understand their body more. And that just, that involves a lot of communication. And so what that always makes me think about is how you're choosing your partners. And I believe, I hope that if the more you know your body, the more, you know, it's not scary or confusing, that you're going to make more positive decisions for yourself. So that's kind of why I like to, you know, start educating young girls to like get to know their bodies and what sensations are, you know, you need to go seek help for, what sensations are normal. And so when you are getting into those stages of looking for, you know, partners and things, that if you have a better sense and confidence for yourself, I hope that that translates into your partnerships.
I'm at an age where a lot of my friends are having their first child or second child, and there's a lot of stress built around this moment, and a lot of individuals that I know are struggling to have a child. And I'm a big believer that the stress of that just monumental moment is what's causing the struggle. And because I know a lot of people that have gone through the scientific routes and paid a lot of money to do so, and then they actually get pregnant to find out the day they have their first child, they're pregnant again with their second child.
Right.
And it took them 7 years to get the first child. And so are there certain things that you encourage couples and women and going through this process, and what kind of things can they come see you for to figure this type of thing out?
Right, great. So again, went back to the, like, systems of flow and just allowing certain systems to have the most optimal access to the hormones, to the blood, to the nerves, the neural impulses. So there is a womb centering massage that that I've adopted from a Mayan abdominal approach and from a Chinate Sung and from a conventional school of education called the Upledger Institute. And the idea behind that is if every organ, you know, has its own place, it's in its home place, and it can move and expand to do its functions, and all the systems and flow will be better. So some fertility clinics have these Mayan abdominal massage therapists, because the Mayan class of abdominal massage really focuses on the womb a lot. Well, those massage therapists are in fertility clinics in some places like New York and California. So that's one aspect as for physical therapy that I would offer. And then there's other things of like timing, to do something like castor oil packs, which helps free up any scar tissue. So those that might have endometriosis or really intense menstruations or scars, abdominal surgeries, freeing up any scar adhesions would be another thing that's, you know, very conservative before you start, you know, working more intensely with the fertility, you know, interventions, IVF and such.
What about depression, like postpartum depression? I mean,
yeah. It's real, and it's, I would love for it to be more understood and not a shameful thing, because it really is beyond the control when you are having the surge of hormones like that. And our town does have great resources. They're building to get help with that. The Hive Collective is a wonderful organization to give all support around the perinatal process. And the there's the Healing Project as well in town. We want these women to go back and exercise, because, you know, that is a hallmark treatment for depression. And that's the juxtaposition of that is your healing, and it's not easy. So going to classes, you know, like this perinatal class that's going to be offered, and there's others in town as well, to help guide you back safely is one of the, another ways that can kind of help with the transition from maiden to mother.
We're speaking with Heather Jean DeFord. Her website is holisticwomb.com. You can go on and see all of the services that she gives, and also some classes and workshops. What do you have coming up?
So in 2023, I'm going to be starting a perinatal yoga class that will be down in Camas. I'm looking forward to serving that population more and giving more services down there. And that's going to be every week, an ongoing class. You can buy punch passes and get a discount. And then in the Rite of Yoga workshop for tweens, for fifth and sixth graders, also in January. And you can register for that on my site as well.
Yes. And moms, what a great thing to send, or parents in general, what a great thing to send your young daughter to, because, and please do, because if your young daughter is anything like I was, or in my case, I remember my mom just made such a big deal about everything. And that's why I didn't want to, you know, I just didn't want to be open with her about it. So why not send your daughter to
a rite of passage? I know. And it's ideally, sure, you would have these, you know, moms and daughters can bond over this, but for lots of reasons, you know, like I pay someone to teach my daughter to swim. I pay, you know, someone to teach my daughter, you know, go to cotillion and learn how to dance, because, you know, you just need, you need other people in your life besides your parents ushering you through these major transitions.
Absolutely. I'm with you. And I wanted to ask you about perinatal.
Yeah.
Peri means on or around.
Yeah.
So there's prenatal, there's postnatal, but this perinatal,
it's all of it.
So you
it's
can
pre and post.
Okay.
I know, right? That's a hard term to kind of wrap your head around. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, Shamanic Twist in Camas.
Yes.
Is located where?
It is right when you come, you know, drive in from Park City. It's right there on the left by the liquor store and the shopping center there. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you take insurance or how does that
HSA all work? Cards? Yeah. Okay. And I'm looking into getting insurance, but we'll see how that goes. Insurance these days is quite complicated.
It is. And yes. It seems that more and more people, yes, happily take your HSA card, but not necessarily your insurance card.
I know. And, you know, with the high deductibles, I've had so many people that just, they pay out of pocket. You know, when I was at the hospital for all those years, they would just have to pay out of pocket.
Right. Yeah. Right. Going back to cranial sacral, mm-hmm. I have had it, you know, occasionally in my mm-hmm. life. And I feel like there is a gift. You know, some people are just gifted to be able to feel the passing of the cranial sacral fluid
right.
because you lay your hands on the cranium. Mm-hmm. And what would you say about that? Because I feel like there, it's hard to find it done, you know, really, really well or effectively. How do you ascertain if you are a seeker of cranial sacral therapy? How do you figure out if someone really knows what they're doing? Because it's so subtle and nuanced, right?
It can be subtle and nuanced. So there's different schools of training for craniosacral. And the one that I've studied, it's definitely a mechanical modality. So it's like changing there's the suture joints, so there's a little bit of play in there. So I have a heavier touch than the training of only 5 grams of pressure sometimes. Sometimes some people need, you know, just that only 5 grams. So I think that that's where there's been confusion, because then I have people say that they were barely touching me and they said that they were doing craniosacral. And I don't know about that type, because that's not the way that I practice, but the craniosacral, if you know that you've got a good treatment, is that how you're going to feel afterward. Is it very strong tell. But then also it's a holistic approach. So kind of treating throughout the whole spine and sacrum is going to be important instead of just focusing on the cranium. And that's another way to kind of tell that you're getting a deep holistic approach.
So you're saying it's more mechanical than mm-hmm. it is woo-woo.
More than energetic. Like some people say, oh, that's an energetic. I'm like, no. I mean, you know, facilitating a change in the joints and in the flow. The, you know, the craniosacral rhythm is a different rhythm than the respiration or the heart rate. And so it does, you have to develop that skill to tune into that rhythm versus all the other rhythms of the body. So it takes a moment to learn that.
Okay.
I would be encouraged to try cranial sacral again, because I've tried it one time and it just didn't do what I expected to come out of it. And I've done a lot of things like acupuncture and energy work. And uh-huh. so it wasn't that I was opposed to it. I was very open to it and it didn't, but my wife goes to craniosacral quite often and she, mm-hmm. it's almost like a therapy session for her. Sure. She comes out of it, you know, with a lot of emotion. And so mm-hmm. for someone like me who was skeptical after the first time, would you encourage to try different practices and stuff? Or maybe I'm just not the type of body that can receive that type of movement, I guess, if you will.
Well, I would say yes and yes. So I find that there's some people that really respond to trigger point, other people that respond to strain counter strain or myofascial. Some people respond really well to craniosacral and some don't. So there is that factor for sure. The emphasis of craniosacral and the way that I treat is to get you in the parasympathetic drive. So that's where your body can heal the best. And so innately, the functions of craniosacral do that, because it's a very soothing, quiet, gentle approach. And so that I would encourage you to do for that kind of relaxation and that deeper, you're talking about the stresses of parenting and all that. So there's that facet of it. But then, you know, I'm one of those therapists that I combine the craniosacral with tissue releasing and joint mobilizations. And so a lot of times when people are done, they're like, you know, what was that? And because it wasn't just strictly craniosacral, but that is definitely woven into it. That approach might, you know, speak to you a little bit better.
It sounds great. Okay, before we let you go, just one quick question. If you know, there are people driving around in this horrible weather and the roads are slick and their jaw is starting to seize up.
Yes.
And I'm one of those people who has a really seized jaw, so I need to come and see you. But what can we do? I do a lot of self-massage on my jaw, but it doesn't work. Oh, yes. How do you explain that?
I know. How do I explain this,
this on
the
audio?
So puff out your cheeks and kind of let them go.
Okay.
How would you verbalize that?
So fill your cheeks with air, close your lips, and then just give a poof.
Yeah. And then a classic way to get rid of any tension in the body is you're feeling a place that's tight. Tighten it more. Tighten it more and more and more and more. And then when you release, the body might find a deeper release. So you could kind of break down. And then when you release, it might be like, oh, there's a little bit more to that. Yeah.
Okay. We're going to do that. I have this thing that I do where I jut out my lower jaw I'm stressed. And it really messes up my bite and
it's crazy. Do you know that has been very common through COVID because the mask wearing? So people would subconsciously jut their jaw because it would help. They'd feel like they're getting better air under their mask. And Lynn, I found this fascinating. I've been doing the jaw since 2004, and getting a locked jaw is kind of a special, like, oh my gosh, you know, it's like a special thing as a jaw therapist.
Special challenge.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen like two of those in the, you know, and then COVID came, 10.
Wow.
Yes.
What is a locked jaw? Literally,
well,
you can't
open it, or maybe you can't close it. The disc gets in the way of the two bones that are coming together, and it get stuck in an open position or a locked position.
Wow. I had my four wisdom teeth out about 10 years ago. I was very old to still have my wisdom teeth. Took them all out. My jaw hasn't been the same since. I think it was the, you know, period of time that they pry your jaw open while I was, you know, I was out. This sort of thing. Very interesting from COVID.
I'll be doing a lot of massaging today.
Yeah, and breath, you know, and breathe. Just deep breaths. Like, that's just going to help everything. But yeah, it's funny. After we have these conversations, people are always like, oh my God, I'm totally aware of my jaw now. That's what happens.
Heather Jean DeFord, Holistic Womb and Jaw.
And Jaw.
But if you'd like to look it up.
Help me with this one.
Right. Holisticwomb.com. All kinds of services. However, all you men out there, you all have a prostate. Think about, is it enlarged? You know, are there issues? Heather can help. Heather, thanks so much for joining us on the Mountain
You're
Life.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And stay with us. We will be back, shifting gears a bit. We'll be speaking with Amy McDonald of Brawley Arts about the evaporating Great Salt Lake and what you can do about it. It's very important. When we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.
This is The Mountain Life. I'm David Windsor.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
A New York Times article from earlier this year reports that evaporating Great Salt Lake, saying that if the lake, which has already shrunk by two-thirds, continues to dry up, there will be a dire consequences. The article calls it an environmental nuclear bomb. But local group proposes that creative solutions and collaboration can help save the land from evaporation. We are joined in the studio by Amy McDonald, the founder of Brawley Arts, who is an artist, is one of the collaborators. She joins us to talk about the upcoming community meeting that will help us help the Great Salt Lake. Amy, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm so excited to be here, and it's such a beautiful snowy day outside.
kind of ironic that we need some water in the Great Salt Lake, and we got a lot of it coming down. So this is a really serious topic, and I've grown up in Utah, and I'm a big skier and a big fan of the outdoors, and this is something that I've known about, but as reading a little bit more into this, knowing you were coming on, I couldn't believe the magnitude at which it's at. And how long has it been going on, and how long have you guys been involved spreading this message about it?
That's a great question. Well, Brawley Arts has been around for a really long time. And the first time I did a project to advocate for Great Salt Lake was in 2004. And the project was called Contours, which is the name of what we call the feathers on birds that aren't related to flight, that gives form, shape, and function to birds. And at that time, Governor Lovett was advocating for the Legacy Highway. And we did a project where we got 400 school kids to learn about endangered birds. We brought in a Tasmanian kite maker. We went out to the lake. We made kites. We learned about endangered birds. And we had a multidisciplinary performance that really showcased the beauty and value of Great Salt Lake. And interestingly enough, as we are such a small organization, it made the headlines about that. Wait a minute, we can't just think that it's okay to run a highway through wetlands that are valuable spots for endangered birds. So that was our first go with creating beauty and value for a space and place. So I've been involved for quite a while, but currently right now the crisis alarm was sounded by Bonnie Baxter on a Radio West interview with Doug Fabrizio last year. The alarm's been going off for over a decade without ears really hearing. But the crisis alarm went off about a year ago, and all of a sudden we're listening.
So what are the things that people are listening about per se? I mean, what kind of things with the legislation or the community is being implemented to help alleviate this or try to turn this around?
That is such a big question, so I'll step into it. So let me shift it back, that when the lake is healthy, when she's really healthy, and one thing to think about is when we talk about Great Salt Lake, call her Great Salt Lake, not the Great Salt Lake, because the Great Salt Lake objectifies her. Great Salt Lake makes her a living, breathing entity that is home to many things. So when she's healthy, she is a home for a major migratory bird stop off for over 10 million birds. She's home to over 260 types of birds, all kinds of wildlife. She's home for recreation, mining, brine shrimping, and she creates a lake effect that allows us to have the greatest snow on earth and keeps our ski season in action and lots of snow for additional 5 to 7 weeks. She also keeps dust wet, so it doesn't fly out. So she's not healthy right now. So none of that is going on. So what's happening is with awareness, let me also say this, a really dear friend, when I stepped into this project, and our project is called Evaporation, What Does It Take to Leave Enough Water for Great Salt Lake? And I went and decided to educate myself as much as I possibly could. So a dear friend and a very wise woman who's in the weeds with this, she said, she works for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. She said, if you want to make change, understand every system that is affecting Great Salt Lake so you can find a pathway to change. So we have really delved into that. So there's a lot to learn. Let's start with that our water policy, which is over 100 years old, is very outdated. And it says that any use of water that is not a beneficial use is not valuable. And at the time that that was created, water in a reservoir, water in a lake, was not deemed beneficial. And so we could consume, we could divert, we could do a lot of different things. Our economic paradigm has left nature out. We have not considered the role of nature, and we're now paying a very dear price. So what's happened is the lake has lost over 50% of its volume. It's too salinated now that the brine shrimp can't reproduce, so the birds are starving. And yesterday the article came out that we're now at the tip of an environmental crisis because the ecosystems at the lake are shutting down. Can we save it? Yes, that's why we're doing it. That's why I'm advocating. And so many of the systems, so our legislators and our governor and a lot of people have gotten involved, and many organizations have advocated for Great Salt Lake, and there are great legislation bills that have passed that will allow water to get to Great Salt Lake. The tricky thing is this beneficial use law that's still in place. We haven't gotten that changed, so you have to jump around lots of different hoops to get water to the lake. The other thing to really think about is to save the lake, it starts with us. And so a lot of these organizations came to us and said, Amy, we have all these ideas and all these things, but express it creatively so people, we can touch hearts and minds. And that's what we do, and that's what we're going to do on Sunday at our event. But it starts with us because we live in a desert. We have the second cheapest water in the nation. We have the second highest consumption of water per capita in the nation, and we live in a desert. It's not sustainable. And so what was really wonderful, I heard Christina Mittermeier, who's a conservationist, and she advocates for indigenous people and their lands, as well as oceans. And she said, you know, indigenous people occupy 6% of the planet, but hold 90% of the knowledge. And she says, we have left them out, and they do not have a voice at a table. And here, we do not consider either Great Salt Lake at the table or the indigenous voice. And it's time to bring that back in to gain solutions. And actually, Laura Briefer, who is the director of public utilities in Salt Lake City, formed a holistic integrated watershed management plan that puts Great Salt Lake and the indigenous voice at the table. And it's gaining a lot of traction, which is really great. So for us, she talks about, don't think about it's up to somebody else. Think about it's up to us. And it starts with us, with conservation.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Amy McDonald. She's the founder of Brawley Arts. She's talking about a project that she has taken on. It's called Evaporation. What does it take to leave enough water for Great Salt Lake? And a community meeting taking place at Alta Ski Resort this coming Sunday. And it will help inform us and get our creative minds going about what we can do to help. And I find it so interesting, Amy, that you, as an artist, you're not a scientist, you're not a water specialist, but it takes an interdisciplinary approach to figure out how to open up, as you say, people's hearts and even their emotion surrounding Great Salt Lake. Talk a little bit, if you would, about how you think this works, because it does seem to me that there are different avenues. We can hear statistics all day long, but somehow out there, as you say, we think someone else is going to take care of those statistics. But putting art into it and appealing to our sense of justice and our sense of urgency is really important. How do you do it?
Well, thanks for asking, because that is how Brawley Arts works. We really take a grassroots approach that everything we do is of, by, for, and with communities we're serving. And since Great Salt Lake doesn't have a voice, we work with those who can speak for her. And we have learned that if we really want to lay the groundwork for change, you have to touch people's hearts and minds. Because once we touch your heart, once you're inspired, once you're engaged, then we can really talk about what's going on, and then we can look for action items, for solutions. And interestingly enough, Aldo Leopold wrote the Sand County Almanac, and it was sort of the landmark conservation book. That was what he advocates, is create value and beauty for something or some place or someone or some creature that you really love in order to get people on board to talk about it. So we have, on Sunday, I'm so excited for this program. We have one of our Brawley Arts pieces is a performance piece, and there is a narrative written by Sophia Katubris, and it's based on history, data, story, fact, and she's written it into a wonderful narrative, and it's called Illusion of Abundance. And I have it here. I can read a little bit at some point if you want. But what we have done is so we have woven all this so that when you hear it and you experience it, we touch your hearts and minds. And we did a sort of proof of concept at the Great Salt Lake Symposium out at Antelope Island, and we wanted to see how it affected people. And at the end of what we presented, I turned and looked at everybody, and there was not a dry eye. And so I thought, okay, we have something. We have a way to step into this now. So Illusion of Abundance is part of our event. And because we're going to the top of the watershed, this is a deliberate decision. We want to start up top, and we will work our way down with different programming. We have invited Dr. Maura Hoffenberger, who's the expert on dust. And we're going to talk about what happens when there are dry lake beds exposed because there are toxic minerals in these lake beds. And when the dust goes, what happens when it goes to the top of the watershed, it melts the snow. We have less water. We have less water that gets into the ground. We have less winter. We have less available water for use. And she's going to talk about that water cycle up there. We also have a Navajo cultural leader coming to talk about the holistic approach around water and also a different kind of a land acknowledgement. We have Caroline Gleick, who is a professional athlete and has used her skills. She has testified in front of the House and Senate for climate justice and equality. And so she's going to speak firsthand about how she uses who she is to advocate for change and give ideas. I think conversation is incredibly important. And so we are going to have opportunities at this event to talk with one another, share information. Because one thing that I committed to when we took on this project is anything that we say or do must be verifiable, because there's a lot of misinformation out there, and we won't ever use blame. So we need to be looking at how we can be positively and constructively working for change to save Great Salt Lake. And I believe we can do it. We still have time, but we have to do it now.
Your passion and emotion towards this is something that's very palpable, and I agree with you that you have to touch people emotionally to get them to change. Otherwise, you're just giving them facts and statistics. My biggest concern is, you know, when things are this grand of a scale, people kind of tend to put them off and say, "It." And how much time do we have before this event could come to fruition as far as completely drying up?
Well, it's starting. We have now. I mean, and what we have, what gives me hope, and I love Jane Goodall's comment that hope is an action verb. Hope catalyzes us into movement and action. We have hope right now because our legislators are engaged, they're involved, they want to see the lake saved. We have people talking about it all the time. And what's really great is there is a coalition of journalists that comprise the Great Salt Lake Collaborative, and they all agreed that anytime any one of them writes an article about Great Salt Lake, they will share it on each other's platforms. So it is constantly in front of people in the news. And by doing that, people now start asking questions. So if we start doing that and we start shifting our consciousness, we can actually move now. If we wait and say, oh, let's see what happens next summer, too late. We need to move now.
And is the problem, I mean, I know it's accumulation of just humankind just living the life that we all live, unfortunately, we've all become accustomed to. And so is the problem, is it less cars on the road? Is it less water consumption? Is it less development? Or is it accumulation of all those things?
It is all those things, and as I said earlier, it's like we have to look at every single system that affects Great Salt Lake. So if we look at the way we use water personally, and if we started saving, conserving water, there would be more. We have to also look at how does agriculture work? Well, the great thing about agriculture is it gets water into the ground, which is what we need. And if we urbanize agricultural lands, we lose that ability to get water into the ground. However, again, back to that old water policy, it was confirmed that in places that are managed and there's bandwidth to oversee it, farmers actually know what their water shares are and how much they have to use. In rural areas in Utah, we've learned that there is no oversight, and when you don't know what your share is, you run your water 24/7. So there's an opportunity for learning, perhaps engagement. The other thing is we have some farmers that farm alfalfa, and alfalfa uses 42% of our available water, and it doesn't stay in the state. It is exported, and we only gain maybe 2 to 3 or 4% of revenue back in. And so perhaps that's, you know, this is high level because water issues are really complicated, but if someone is farming alfalfa in a desert, maybe we take a look. Could we farm something else? The other thing we have is our governor is an alfalfa farmer. And so he's learning about that. We have farmers that have shifted to drip. And they use very little water. So there's that opportunity. Utah is a pro-growth state. And I go back to that economic paradigm where we haven't considered nature. So what if we shifted the way we look at growth and said, let's look at how we grow? And we put nature, Great Salt Lake, at the table. So maybe that shifts how we think about it. And Christina Mittermeier, again, to quote her, she said, there's a really wonderful indigenous saying that said, take what you need, but use all that you take. And if you consider yourself a citizen of planet Earth, then you look at things differently. And so I think we really have to be very vocal about, let's talk about how we're growing. If we do nothing, there's a chance Utah's out of water by 2040 for all development.
And that's just around the corner. You know, one of the things, Amy, that we up here in our little ivory tower of Park City, we think that, oh, we could never live in Salt Lake because the air quality is so bad. And we're up here with our beautiful snow. And this is so much a part of our lives and who we are and what this economy is in this little mountain town. And we don't think about something like Great Salt Lake evaporating and the ensuing air quality that will be here and that really is here now. I mean, anyone who's lived through, you know, in the spring or fall, especially the spring, when there's a dust storm that comes across, you see it on your windows, you see it on the snow, you see it now. And I just wonder about raising awareness here in this community. We feel like we're far removed, but we so aren't.
Thank you for bringing that up, because that's one thing that Maura will really talk about on Sunday and that we've learned. And we have a case study that we can learn from, which is Owens Lake in California. Our dust has a lot of arsenic in it, and it's the thing that's triggering people. And last spring, we saw it in the snow, the brown dust, when there's a dust storm. When those particles are out and they get into your lungs, they don't leave. They stay there, and they kind of wreak havoc. And one thing that we learned when we studied Owens Lake, so in the early 1900s, Owens Lake was depleted to give water to Los Angeles. And the manner in which they did that harmed indigenous populations, harmed the environment, and depleted the lake. Well, the lake in this dry bed, every year, even now that they've gotten some water back to Owens Lake, and the part where that has lake is recovering, which is a good idea for us, the other parts still don't meet EPA standards. And every year, 300,000 tons of toxic dust goes in the air. It's coming here, it's coming in wilderness areas, and this dust comes down. Great Salt Lake is 12 times bigger than Owens Lake, to put it in perspective. So in 2021, Maura documented a dust storm here off of Great Salt Lake that was at that high toxic level that dumped up on the ski resort. So we're not immune up here. It comes up here when the wind blows. So really, like I say, I have tons of hope, and I'm optimistic, and I'm a realistic optimist, because we do have ways to make change to save this. But I think it is really important. And it was really interesting. I took Al Gore's climate reality leadership training, and he said when there's a big environmental issue, there's three questions that you have to ask. One, must we change? So we've got to look at how we're using water, and we're looking that water rights have been overallocated. We have, you know, consumption, our ethic, we've got dust, all this stuff. So yeah, we must change. And the next question is, can we change? Do we have the know-how? Do we have the resources? Do we have the expertise? Do we have political will? I'd say more or less yes. And then the third question, which is really the most important one, is will we change? So that's up to us. We can save Great Salt Lake if we change.
The meeting coming up on Sunday, November 13th, is, I just had it up, it's at Alta in the
Our Lady of the Snows Community Center at 3:30 p.m. And again, it's a deliberate choice so we can be at the top of the watershed and that we can have a great event and get people down the hill for dinner.
So. That's right. So the tickets are $5, and I suppose that's just so you know who's coming and what the numbers are. Yeah. Is it a limited number?
Yep.
At this point,
we are more than halfway sold, and we'd love to have people come. So if you go to altacommunity.org/events, you can get your ticket. Our partner, Alta Community Enrichment, or ACE, the director, Sarah Gibbs, is hosting us and partnering with us to present our event.
I'm just sitting here quietly getting a little like emotional, because I'm in construction. And I know that my industry, especially up in Park City, of building these big homes for a small family that doesn't necessarily need that amount of square footage, it it really pulls at me because it's a conflicting of interest, as this is my way of living, but this is my way of life is the skiing in the mountains and the snow. And I don't necessarily have a follow-up question with that. I know, you know, must we change, can we change, will we change is in order for all of us. And I'm a part of that. And I'm strategically already trying to figure out ways how I can integrate this into my career and my life moving forward. So I appreciate your time to give us the insight for, you know, what's to come and how we can help to change it.
I think it all starts with us. And once you say, I'm a citizen of planet Earth, and when we start having those conversations, it's like dropping a pebble in a silent body of water in that ripple effect. That's how change starts happening, because suddenly not doing anything is not acceptable. So it's like, mm-hmm. It's a cultural shift.
Well, also, if you look at, you know, say the economy that David is in, we're not going to have that economy if we are breathing toxic air.
Exactly.
You know, this town will not survive if the air is so toxic. So we all are implicated in this question. Really, it's a big one, and it's urgent, and it is at a crisis level.
And, you know, there's places like Nevada that said, hey, let's come together and let's agree that there's going to be water limits and we'll live here. But I say that I'm very hopeful. I think there is a lot I know that we can do. And so I'm excited for our conversation on Sunday. And I'm so excited that you invited me here today.
Well, we're very happy to have you. Amy McDonald, the founder of Brawley Arts. And again, this Sunday, November 13th, 3:30 p.m., you can go to brawleyarts.org.
You can go to brawleyarts.org or altacommunity.org/events and get a ticket.
And thanks to our listeners. Thanks also to our underwriters, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. You've been listening to KPCW Park City.